All right, welcome, folks, to Lecture 37 in this American History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. Today's lecture is entitled The Idea of Western Planting. So if that seems like a strange title to you, that's all right. We will explain the use of the connotation of the term planting in this context shortly enough. But I wanted to emphasize this posture, I'm going to call it, that we are going to be adopting with regard to the past. This predictive posture that I want you to start adopting with regard to the information that I present to you. And by that I mean that at every point in our story, as we are learning about the next series of events, the next set of characters, and so on, that's unfolding, it's an important thing. I consider it to be a really important thing that you adopt the posture of thinking of what you expect to be happening, predicting what you expect the story to look like. As somebody that has an awareness of things the way that things are going to turn out, because the whole point of studying history is what? It's not to merely know these things. It's not merely for you to sit there passively as a receptor of content, which I transmit and you receive, and then, rinse, repeat. And at the end, some of it sticks, some of it doesn't, whatever. You're a little bit more cultured than the person next to you, but basically it's of no consequence. That particular approach to history is anathema to me. To me, the crucial thing about history is I agree entirely with, as it turns out, the founding fathers. To me, history is powerful knowledge. Thomas Jefferson said, history is that knowledge most useful to us. And I would go so far as to say that the United States of America could not exist without the power of history, wielded by the founding fathers the way that they did. And so it's a powerful thing, but power means that it's useful, that it has some practical use. The studying of all these facts isn't an end in itself. It's not like looking at a work of art where you just enjoy it and then you go on with your life. This, the science of history, is a practical science. And the practice of it, the usefulness of it, the practical value of it is, it takes different forms. But ultimately, one of the most powerful and important things that it yields is a predictive mindset. A predictive mindset. We were kind of talking about that a little bit yesterday, about the power of a predictive mindset. I think I was telling you about how investors, for instance, in economic activities, in this very, very complex global market that we live in, there are quite a few, not that many, but still quite a few people out there that are billionaires. And certainly many, many, many multimillionaires out there. And one of the most important things that those people do is predict. One of the reasons, probably the, I don't know, I haven't thought of this before, but probably one of the most important reasons why they're richer than everybody else is because they have the capacity to predict. They know what the future is going to be. And knowing what the future is in advance is of what use? What is the practical value of it? To know what's going to happen, especially before other people know, but just, for it, I mean, that's a different issue, right? But just, what's the value, without it being a competitive thing, what's the value of knowing what the future is going to be? I admit that's a very philosophical question, right? So it's like, wow, that's a big one, Mr. Powell. Like, well, you're blowing my mind with the value of knowing the future. That's kind of big. So maybe I need to specify it for you there. But anyway, Keen's willing to try this one out. Go ahead, Keen.
Well, you can make decisions based on things that haven't happened yet. So if you know, this is not a great example, but if you know that an asteroid is going to crash into where you live, and if you were able to see that, you can get out of the way before you can see it in the sky, at which point you don't have the time to get out of the way. So if you transport that over to history, where it's not an asteroid, you know, if you know, Mr. Powell gave this example yesterday, if you know that Hitler is rising and that he doesn't like the Jews and you're Jewish, and if you understand history, then you can get out of the way before he comes and tries to kill you.
Okay, right, okay. So, yeah, that's a good approach to it, Keen, is to concretize, right? When you have a really big abstraction like the future, the best thing to do with it is to try to concretize it, make it into something that you can, feel is real for you, right? So, yeah, absolutely. Now, and we live in a time which is really interesting in that regard. So we live in a time with a globalized economic activity. It's very hard to predict what's going to be happening. And especially because one government bureaucrat can just click a keyboard and all of a sudden all kinds of things are different in the world that we live in terms of the economy. So a lot of people spend a lot of their time in the economy trying to predict what the government's going to do. Is the government going to okay the Keystone Pipeline? You know, that's a big one nowadays. You might have heard of that one. Or is the government going to do certain things with regard to immigration? Is the government going to do this or that? Now, if you know the answer, you get to move first, or you get to move before others. Put yourself in a position. Let's say you predict that somebody is going to need a lot of construction equipment. Well, so, and you have the capability of manufacturing that? Well, you can get ahead of the game. And you can start manufacturing it in advance and be in a position to meet the demand when it arises. Of course, if your prediction's wrong, then you could end up bankrupting yourself, right? But so predictions are always difficult, and there are a lot of dangers associated with it. But if you're good at it, and it's not impossible, you can benefit greatly from having a predictive capacity. It's a general trait. It can have positive outcomes for you in your life in a lot of different ways. It can be as simple as you are running a business in your life, and you are seeing that the market for your product is changing. Being able to predict how that happens might allow you to succeed or thrive in your business better than you would otherwise. For instance, I'll give you a really good example nowadays. I am amazed by and super excited by ebooks and the whole electronic publishing industry. This is an amazing and wonderful phenomenon, and when I write my book, I'm working on it now, it's going to be, obviously going to be, I mean, I'll publish it as a real book, it's not even the right word to use, as a physical paper book, but where it's at in terms of distribution and in terms of reaching people is by making it available as an ebook, and then by extension, possibly as an audio book, and in different formats and so on. Now, this whole e-commerce, this whole e-publishing sector has been very what's called disruptive. And there have been people who are just not paying attention to it, and they're in big, big trouble. So these big publishing companies out there, Hachette is the one that comes to mind immediately, and they're really upset about the fact that the world has changed. And that they can't keep on doing things the way they wanted to do them before. And they've been making a lot of noise in the publishing industry about how Amazon is terrible and the world changing is a bad thing. Because, of course, they're losing a lot of money. Because they did not properly predict what would happen to publishing as a result of the internet, as a result of tablets, as a result of all of these technologies. So their failure to predict is probably going to lead to them, their business, going out of business, which for them is multi-million dollar industry. So, too bad they didn't know to predict. So sometimes it's life or death, sometimes it's just riches or poverty. But either way, it's a big deal. It's an absolutely a big deal. The ability to, this predictive mindset is very powerful. And this is one of the things that studying history can do for you, is give you the power of a predictive mindset. And it's such a neat thing, because what we do is we study the past. So you wouldn't think that studying the past is going to give you this advantage, right? But we were talking the other day about Winston Churchill and Thucydides, and Winston Churchill said very rightly that the predictive capacity comes from the ability to look backwards. That's the thing that's perhaps unintuitive, right? Counterintuitive. This is a great quote. The farther backward you can look, the farther forward you can see. So I might switch that around. I don't know. The further backward you can see, I would prefer the quote to be, the farther backward you can see, the farther forward you can look. But anyway, sometimes it's just a little subtle difference. But that's a great quote. And of course, as I was saying, the reason why was identified by Thucydides, because the future resembles or reflects the past. And this is absolutely true. And so resemble meaning it's similar to, or reflect meaning it's identical to, in essential regards, identical. So if we study the past and become adept at observing this fact, we're working our predictive muscles. We're going to start to become people who have the capacity to look around us and see that the world around us is also a set of circumstances that has a future, and that future is going to resemble or reflect other circumstances that have previously developed that we're aware of. And therefore, we can know, we can predict what it's going to look like. So, as I was saying the other day, and I had trouble asking the question of you guys. I had trouble asking the question, but I think ultimately we got to it. It was a little bit painful getting there. But the question I had for you was, what's so great about, I mean, if we're going to look at this era right now, after Columbus, after 1492, in the age of discovery and so on, and make predictions about what we're going to see in American history. What's so great about that is that from our current vantage point, that's not the future. From our vantage point, 2014, those things that we're going to be making predictions about are the past. They are the events of 1607, the events of 1620, the events of 1648. To us, all that's in the past. So we can make predictions and test them. Make predictions and test them. Make predictions and check them. Make predictions and see. Did we do well? Did we do not? And so on. And so we have an amazing, vast database of examples to work with. Predict, success or failure. Predict, success or failure. Predict, success. And so you can develop this predictive muscle of yours and get really good at it. So the power of prediction is the power of life or death, is the power of values or non-values. And if you want that power, no better place to work on it than history. No better. Literally no better. Because the thing about history is it happened. It's real. So if you want to test your understanding, your capacity to understand the world, go look at a past situation. Test your knowledge. Push and think and try to understand what would happen here, and then see. And then you collect that together, and hopefully you're building a tower of understanding along with your tower of knowledge. They go together. All right, well, enough theory. Let's get to examples of this. Let me remind you of an example of this, okay, that we did. Right? Using our anchor facts. Because once we had our anchor facts, we started to have the ability to be a predictor. So recall this example. I asked you guys this in class. After the fall of Rome, with these various barbarian tribes, shaping their tribes into nations. I asked you this. What kind of governments would they have? What was I doing? I was saying, be a predictor. And you had the answer. You had the answer. Hold on a sec. I'm going to turn off the hand-raising noise. Excuse me for a second. I'm going to figure this out. I have a hand-raising noise. But I think somebody was going to answer. Go ahead. Who was that? I asked you, what kind of governments would they have? And, of course, why? Not a wild, meaningless guess, but an anchored prediction. Ben?
Monarchy.
Okay, and why?
Because, with few exceptions, that was all they had ever had.
Yeah, okay. And not just few exceptions. It really was absolutely the only form of government that people ever had. Unless they could think their way out of that box. And there were only two groups of people that had ever successfully thought their way out of that box. The Greeks and the Romans. And those examples had collapsed. So, we have now the context for a prediction. We can say with a high degree of certainty, maybe not certainty, but a super high degree of probability, that these primitive people, say it with certainty, that these people are going to have monarchies. That would be a prediction. The only reason we couldn't call it certain is you would say, well, there might be some knowledge there that we don't know. But since there was no basis for expecting that the Germanic tribes had any knowledge of proper government, there was no basis, then we could attach a probability of certainty to our prediction. They're going to have monarchies. There's nothing else they could possibly come up with. They've got way too far to climb to figure out what the Athenians and Romans understood. So yeah, that's prediction. That's prediction. So let's do it again here in terms of the content now for today's lecture and for the next segment of our studies here. We've been looking at a period of history in which Europeans were looking at America in a certain way. I'll remind you of how here, symbolically, we have a great map that tells us a lot about how Europeans were looking at the Americas, right? Remember how we had an in-class quiz about when was this map? And we came up with, 1507 or so, before 1519 for sure, right? Because there's no bottom to South America. But there was another essential point about this map. And it was, how did Europeans view America? So what's the answer based on this map? How did Europeans view America based on this map? And remember, I'll give you a hint. What's this over here? That's a big, big hint. What's all this space up here? Huge hint. Why is it so skinny? Another huge hint. Juliet?
Well, they thought it could be circumnavigated.
Well, okay, but that's not the main answer that I'm looking for. They thought is actually not the right word. Can you choose a different word? Can you see what I'm getting at here, Julia?
They guessed?
Yeah, they guessed. There's even a better word than that. You're on the right track, Julia. They guessed, and the sad is that they didn't know, so they couldn't really think the answer. I mean, they could only guess. So it's not a thought because it wasn't based on any evidence. But, Timothy?
Well,
that America can be circumnavigated.
There you go. That's the best word. This is a map of hope. They wanted there to be a hole there. They wanted there to be a huge empty sea up here. They didn't. This is an interesting one down here. They knew that this land went down there, didn't know where the bottom was. So I'm kind of surprised that this map maker didn't show a bottom to South America. That would have been, I think, more. But they did show lots of rivers. And there's always, if you got a short, small continent, maybe you can go up this river and down this river. So there are quite a few features here that speak of hope, right? But now, so now, what does that reflect? Why? What does that tell us about what they were thinking of America? Keen?
They thought it was in the way
because
they wanted to.
That's exactly it. They thought it was in the way. And so their hope, their profound hope was, maybe it's not so much in the way. Maybe it's easy to get around. Because for the most part, they thought this is a waste of time. This is not where we want to be. This is not where we want to go. Because there is no Cathay here. There is no Sabangu here. There really isn't anything worth a heck of a lot here in terms of trade. So when are they going to stop? Actually, here's my predictive question for you, as I have to put it in the right words, otherwise it might not come off all too well. When are they going to start coming to America? Here's my predictive question for you. When are they going to start coming to America? If they think that America's in the way, when are they going to start coming here? Now, before you answer, and a few people want to try, but before you answer, I want to remind you of how powerful your personal awareness is already. You didn't realize it was powerful yet, but you do have a powerful advantage when it comes to studying these questions, and that is you know certain things. You know that they are going to come. You know that. You know that Europeans are going to come here. Right? Everybody here absolutely knows that for sure, right? Anybody not feel certain that they're going to come? How do you know they're going to come here? I'm going to put some people on the spot here. Peyton, how about you? You know it, don't you?
No, I actually don't.
Yes, you do. And the only problem is you don't know that you know it. You do know it.
I actually don't think I do.
Yes, you do. I guarantee you, there's not a single person here that doesn't know it. We know that Europeans are going to come here. Absolutely 100% know it. Do you know it, Declan?
The Europeans, they are going to, they want to try to.
No. How do you personally know it, that they're coming here?
Because we wouldn't be here today if they didn't.
There we go! You are here! That's why! You are here! How on earth could you possibly be here if they hadn't come here? It's not possible! How could there be a United States of America if they had not come? See what I mean? Peyton, now you know that you knew, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you just didn't know it. You knew it, but you didn't know that you knew it. So this is so hard to do. It's so funny because I don't know, we are not often enough reminded to think in certain ways with regard to the past, to summon what we know about the world around us. And use that to know the past, and use the past to know the world around us, and know the future, and so on. This perspective of tying it all together is not common nowadays. If you go into a normal history class for students your age, there'll be a textbook, and that textbook will be full of stuff about the past. And never once will you be asked a question like that, which is weird. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It does if you understand the history of history itself, which is a whole separate subject that's quite fascinating. How did we get to this point that history has become so useless when it shouldn't be? When the Greeks who invented it intended it as a practical power, and the Founding Fathers understood it as a practical power, and so all of a sudden now we're in a strange place where everybody thinks it's useless, and everybody just doesn't have a clue exactly how to proceed, even in the most basic way. You know so much about history, but you don't even realize it, because you haven't been encouraged to see how much you know. You have not been encouraged to see that you know a lot just by looking around you. So we know they're going to come. So now here's the question is, predict something. All right, here's where we get to the more difficult question. So everybody here, I hope, is now comfortable with the fact that you know that Europeans are going to go to America. You know it. Now I want you to think here. I want you to create an interconnection in your mind. This map shows us that Europeans want to go through America. They want to go around it. What has to happen? These two things don't go together. You know for a fact that Europeans came here and settled here and made new countries and established a whole new civilization here. So at some point, they decided to do that. This map tells us they only think of America as an obstacle. They don't want to go there. So what has to happen? What has to happen in between these two things? Do you get my question? You know that they came, but this map tells us they don't want to. So Timothy thinks he's on the right track. Is he the only one? This map tells us they don't want to come here. But we know that eventually they did. So what has to happen? Again, you know the answer, but I think you're not willing to go out on a limb. This is not that big of a question. Timothy, let's see what you can come up with.
Okay, I think what would have to happen, which did, I think in the 1500s, is the first circumnavigation of the globe, because then the Europeans realized that, oh, it's actually not faster, it's actually slower.
How does that lead them to want to come to America?
Because they realized, oh, well, the only way we can go, the fastest way we can get to Cathay and Cipangu is if we go east. But now we have this whole new other world to colonize and make territories and build empires.
But I see your point, but no, because why would they colonize at all is my question. I think I see what you're trying to say. You're trying to say, Timothy, that basically they would get to the point where they'd get kind of discouraged about going west, like Columbus said, and therefore, well, what's left? Is that it? It's kind of like the consolation prize. All right, well, yeah, but civilizations don't get built based on a consolation prize. So not quite. No, that's not the answer. Juliet?
They changed their mind.
Thank you, Juliet. Somebody had to change their mind. That's all. See, I was trying to tell you guys, you know the answer. But again, you are not sure about your own awareness. Now, that's not a difficult thought, right? What I told you was, they're looking at America as an obstacle. We know that later, though, they come to America and stay here. Well, that's not the action of somebody that thinks of a place as an obstacle. That's the action of somebody who thinks of a place as a new home. So what had to happen? They had to change their minds. Somebody had to say, let's stop thinking of this place as an obstacle. It's not just, so Timothy, your answer was kind of right in the sense that somebody had to say, well, all right, that's not the best way to get to Asia. It really isn't. It's just really far. So you got to cross the Atlantic Ocean, go around the continent, and cross the Pacific Ocean. Not such a great way to go. So let's rethink that. That's true. But the other thing is, they got to have a reason to go there. They got to have a reason to go there. And when are they going to do that? Let me ask you, when are they going to do that? Look at this map that we've used before. And tell me what on this map gives us a clue about the timing of when they're finally going to start changing their minds. Okay, this map shows us and gives us a pretty good estimate of when they're finally going to change their minds. So when did they start to change their minds? Do you get the question? When did Europeans stop looking at America as an obstacle? So where's the information? And everything on here is dated. So all you got to do is look at every Western voyage and give me a sense, give me an educated statement concerning when did they stop looking at America as an obstacle. Okay, Bria.
It's sort of in the 1500s, 1500s, and 1400s.
That's way too vague. Way too vague. 1400s, absolutely not, because Columbus is not trying to get to America. Nothing Columbus did was about the Americas. It was always about Asia. And we know, what is Magellan doing? What is Magellan doing? How does he view America, and how do we know? Keen?
He tried to get around it, and actually he succeeded.
Okay. Bria, did you understand that answer? Okay. He viewed it as an obstacle, because what did he do? He didn't go here like Columbus. Look what he did. He went down here and crawled along the coast until he could finally find the end of it and get past it. And then right away, what does he do? Bam, shoot, straight shot across to Cathay. Okay. Now we've got a part of the information. When do Europeans stop thinking that way? What other clues do we have on our map? We don't have that many. What does this one up here tell us? What does that trip up there tell us? Frobisher, 1576. What's up with that? Give you a little bit of time to think of the answer. What's the weather up there in that part of the world like, Piper?
Is it cold or warm?
What is this up here? What is this part of the world? This is Greenland. These are the Northwest Territories of Canada. What's it like up there?
It's
cold.
Super, super cold. All right, so why is he going there, Brie? Why is he going there, Viper?
Because he thinks it's warm.
No. No, definitely not. Definitely not. So, all right. Why would he go there? Why would he go there? Juliet, can you help out?
To try to go up and around.
To try to go around. We still look at all this water over here, right? This is water. This is water. Go back to this map. Go back to this map. Where is our Waldseemüller map? What does it say over here? In this corner. It says there's lots of water over here. So if I'm Frobisher, I guess I gotta annotate this map here. If I'm Frobisher and I'm leaving England, then I'm gonna go over here and I'm gonna go over the top of this thing. That was the search for northern passages. So why is Martin Frobisher going there in 1576? Pardon me, let me bring it back. Because he wants to try to go over top. He's definitely not going there. It's almost nobody ever has lived up there, even today with all the modern technology. Very, very few people up there. It's absolutely frozen solid, and that's the problem. There's water there, but it's all ice. There's no way to get past that spot. So it's impossible without modern technology. Nowadays, with the incredible modern technology that we have, they build ships. The hulls are like a meter thick of steel, and the ships are powered by nuclear power plants, and they can break through the ice. But back then, nobody could do it. So now we have some information. 1576. What's Frobisher trying to do? He's trying to get around. Okay. Who else? Have we gotten past the concept yet? Who else is trying to get around? It's obvious. There's not much left. Sophie, who's next? Drake, in what year?
1577.
Okay, I can barely hear you. You might need to upgrade your microphone. Right, Drake, 1577 to 1580. He's copying Magellan. He's going down here, and he's going up the coast. Let me ask you guys a trick question. That's not a trick question. Why is he going up the coast? If his main purpose is to go around, why is he going up the coast? Timothy?
Because he's going up the coast to see, because if there's land on the other side, that means that there's no possible way because to sail just straight directly, because first of all, there'll be land. If there's land on the other side, that means there is land blocking it. So there is that he's trying to prove, is there land or is there not land on this other side?
Perfect. Exactly. If there's land over here, then there's land, period. Right? So you can go on this side as many times as you want, and you got a problem. You haven't yet seen it all. So you can go on this side and work your way around here all you want. Or you could use another technique. You know where the other side is, so you work your way along the other side, and if you don't find any gaps, you know there aren't any. So that's what he did, all the way up to here, until such time, and he's doing his calculations, and he says, this is a waste of time, I'm going to Asia. So, you know, he'd given up, basically, at that point. There's no point in going further than this. There's no gaps here. So we still haven't gotten to the new idea. We still haven't gotten to the new idea. So in 1576, Sir Humphrey Gilbert, one of the leaders of English exploration, wrote a treatise called a discourse of a discovery for a new passage to Cathay. That's very revealing. Keen, make sure to get this down for your own notes. 1576, one of the leaders of English exploration, Sir Humphrey Gilbert, is still writing these tracts. He's still writing these kinds of essays. A discourse of a discovery for a new passage to Cathay. What's on his mind is Cathay. That's why Frobisher is going. What Gilbert was talking about here? The search for the Northern Passage. He's talking about the search for a Northern Passage. And Frobisher is one of the ones trying to do it. And actually, that obsession continued for quite a long time. It continued well into the 1600s. So it still wasn't, this obsession with the Northern Passage still was not overcome. So it took them a long time. But Juliet was the one who got us to the answer. That somebody's got to change their minds. If history's going to be what we know that it is, because we're here, we know there's a civilization in the Americas. So people came. So we know, we can predict, with hindsight, awesome power of hindsight, we can start to train our predictive capacity. We know, okay, somebody's going to change their minds about this. We know to look for somebody who's going to articulate a new point of view. We need history changes when people have new thoughts. Right? We know that too. Right? History changes when people have new thoughts. Otherwise, it doesn't change. What a sorry state of affairs. One half of human history. That's pretty sad, huh? That's pretty pitiful. 2,500 years of people putting up with the same terrible kind of government. You're not going to get anything different until somebody turns on their thinking caps and creates it, invents it, originates it. All of which means thinks it. Somebody's got to think it. Think it up. Make it for the first time. So in our story, that person is a man named Richard Hakluyt. Among the first. I think of all the ones out there, that's probably the most significant, at least because he was English. And yes, the Spanish and the Portuguese were already getting started, so they had kind of gotten the head start on things. But Richard Hakluyt is the Englishman who's going to publish a new essay, 1584. And that essay isn't about Cathay. That essay is about America. And Richard Hakluyt says to his fellow Englishmen, we should go planting in the West. His essay is called Discourse on Western Planting. Now, what does he mean? What does he mean by planting? This was the key word of the day, right in our lecture title. We're pretty much done for today. But what did he mean by planting? It's kind of metaphorical, but metaphorical language. He doesn't mean plants. So if you're going to guess that, we can set that aside. So if he doesn't mean plants, what does he mean? Juliet?
Colonization?
Yeah, he means colonization. He means planting people. He means taking people, uprooting them from their homes, and making new roots somewhere else. Because, you know, people are not the same as plants in the sense that we can move around, but we have a similar, certain similar qualities in the sense that we also like to put down roots. We also like the idea of home. We also tend to feel more connected to a certain place and a culture and so on, which we feel is our home. And so that's what he means by planting. We're going to uproot certain people and we're going to plant them in a new place. We're going to make a colony. So tomorrow we'll talk about why. Why do this? What does it mean to plant a colony? And why should anybody do this? This is a huge part of how the United States ever comes to be. There has to be people from Europe coming here and staying, building a life for themselves, wanting to be here, planting a new civilization. Otherwise, America's just an obstacle. So we'll talk more about Richard Hakluyt tomorrow and the idea of planting colonies in the Americas. All right. That's going to be it for today. Thanks, everybody.
Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Chappelle.
Bye.